This weekend, only at Macy's, it's our lowest prices of spring. How low? Diamond rings, pendants, and earrings, only $399, originally $1,500. Ninja blenders, now $89.99. And $395 men's designer suits, only $99.99. So if you're wondering why you should shop Macy's lowest prices sale, well, the name pretty much says it all. It's our lowest prices for one weekend only. Starts tomorrow at Macy's. Savings off already reduced prices. Exclusions apply.
Before the Black Riders strike, before the knife flashes in the night, a story is shared. A story of love, defiance, and courage against overwhelming darkness. Will it be enough to keep the cold shadow at bay? Today we finish our five-part exploration of the chapter A Knife in the Dark from J.R.R. Tolkien's Fellowship of the Ring. Wander farther with my free chapter guide, which you can download at ringspodcast.com/attack. I'm Aaron, your guide to wandering Middle-earth, and this is Lore of the Rings. Now, let's wander. The night presses in. The wind bites colder. The darkness thickens, and fear creeps closer. Frodo and his companions sit huddled beneath the ruined watchtower of Weathertop, aware that the Black Riders are near, but uncertain of when or how they will strike. Strider knows the weight of fear well. He's lived in its shadow for years, traveling long, lonely roads, often with danger lurking just beyond his sight. But he also knows the power of stories. So, like a father comforting his children around a dying fire, he does what countless before him have done in the face of darkness. He tells a tale. Strider, ever the practical ranger, first sees to the basics, fire and food. These small comforts are a shield against despair. Fire keeps the dark at bay. A meal, however meager, reminds them of the simple joys of life. But Strider knows that survival is not only about physical needs. Fear gnaws at the mind, just as hunger gnaws at the stomach. And so he turns to words. Quote, to keep their minds from fear, he tells them tales of long ago. But not just any tales. The ancient stories of Middle-earth hold power. The weight of history, of long-forgotten struggles, of great deeds that shaped the world. In doing this, Strider follows an old tradition. The elves, the Dúnedain, even the hobbits, stories have always been a way of passing on wisdom, of reminding people that they are part of something far greater than their own small struggles. And here, on the cold, crumbling hill of Weathertop, that tradition continues. Merry asks about Gil-galad, the last great elven king of Middle-earth. Sam has already recited part of a song about him earlier in the chapter, and we explored in episode number 203. But Strider hesitates. Why? Because the story of Gil-galad is not one of hope. It is one of loss. The last High King of the Noldor fought valiantly against Sauron in the War of the Last Alliance. He stood beside Elendil, the greatest of the Men of the West, and yet, despite all his might, he fell. His death was one of the many sacrifices that ended the Second Age, but the darkness was never truly defeated. It only retreated, waiting for its time to rise again. And now that darkness is here. The servants of the enemy are close. Strider will not speak of the fall of Gil-galad when the shadow of the past feels so much like the shadow of the present. So he chooses another story. Quote, I will tell you the tale of Tenuviel. It is a fair tale, though it is sad, as are all the tales of Middle-earth, and yet it may lift up your hearts. This is the story of Beren and Lúthien, a tale of defiance, a tale of two lovers who dared to stand against Morgoth himself, the first and greatest Dark Lord. It is not a story of kings and armies, but of individuals, highly underestimated individuals, who fought against overwhelming darkness, driven by love and unwavering courage. Unlike Gil-galad's story, which ends in death and retreat, the tale of Beren and Lúthien is one of hope that lingers even in sorrow. It is a song that has endured for thousands of years, one that Strider himself holds close to his heart. He does not yet tell the hobbits why this story matters to him personally. He simply offers them its beauty, its sadness, its strength. And so, on this cold and fearful night, as the shadows lengthen and the weight of the world presses down, the future King of Gondor does what his ancestors have done for generations. He tells a tale. A tale to keep the darkness at bay. Now, we'll get to this tale in just a moment, but before we do, we need to take a look at how this scene is adapted in Peter Jackson's Fellowship of the Ring movie. In the extended edition, we get a quiet but deeply significant moment between Frodo and Strider. One night, as the hobbits sleep, Strider sits alone, softly singing in Elvish. Frodo wakes and asks what he is singing. Strider responds that it is the Lay of Lúthien, the tale of an elven maiden who gave her love to a mortal man. When Frodo asks what happened to her, Strider answers simply, "She died." It's a brief exchange, but it carries immense weight. Strider's choice of song here is deeply personal. While Strider of the book uses the Lay of Lúthien as a story to uplift the hobbits, film Strider sings it almost to himself, lost in quiet reflection. The difference is subtle but important. In both versions, this story matters to him, but the film emphasizes, ever so slightly, its personal connection to his own life. Strider, the mortal man, is in love with Arwen, an immortal elf. Like Beren and Lúthien before them, they must face the painful consequences of their love, chief among them, mortality and death. But the real emotional sting is in Strider's final words, "She died." Lúthien made an impossible choice, to give up her immortality and share the fate of mortal men. And when she died, her spirit did not go to the halls of Mondos, where all elves go, but to the unknown destiny of men, beyond the reach of even the Valar. For elves, there is no greater sorrow than this separation. It is the ultimate tragedy. Strider does not elaborate, but in that moment we sense the depth of his thoughts. He does not need to say that he sees himself and Arwen in this story. It is written in his face. And perhaps there is another layer here, a flicker of doubt. If Lúthien, the most beautiful and powerful of the Eldar, could not escape death, what hope is there for him? What will become of him and Arwen? This small addition to the film is a masterstroke of subtle storytelling. It condenses an entire theme, love, loss, and mortality, into a few soft-spoken words, and it lingers, much like the Lay of Lúthien itself, in the background of Strider's journey. Now let's explore the song that Strider shares with the hobbits. The fire crackles against the cold night air. The stars glimmer above the broken ruins of Weathertop. Fear hangs heavy, but Strider knows the power of a well-timed story. And so he begins to sing. The Lay of Lúthien is not just a song. It is an echo from the Elder Days, a legend of love and defiance against the greatest darkness the world has ever known. For first-time readers, this moment in the Fellowship of the Ring may seem like an aside, a poetic interlude in the middle of an otherwise tense chapter. But Tolkien does not place this song here by accident. And while you might be forgiven for skipping the songs as you read the novel, this is the one exception. Do not skip this poem. This is a story that has shaped Middle-earth, and as we'll see, it is a story that will shape the Lord of the Rings itself. The Lay of Lúthien is one of the longer poems that Tolkien includes in the Lord of the Rings, but the full poem is actually much longer, and if I remember correctly, was left unfinished at the time of Tolkien's death. Its rhythm is flowing and musical, almost hypnotic in the way it carries the listener through the story. This reflects its in-world purpose. It is not just a story, but a song, meant to be remembered and passed down. The poem tells the tale of Lúthien, the most beautiful of the elves, who falls in love with Beren, a mortal man. But their love is forbidden. Lúthien's father, Fingol, sets Beren an impossible task, to claim a Silmaril from the Iron Crown of Morgoth, the Dark Lord of the First Age and Sauron's master. A first-time reader may not realize the sheer scale of this challenge. Morgoth is no mere villain. He is the first and greatest Dark Lord, far more terrible than Sauron. To steal from his crown is to stand against the ultimate power of evil. And yet Beren accepts the quest, not because he believes he can win, but because love has given him the courage to try. This poem briefly recounts only how Beren met Lúthien, in despair and madness, but does not follow their full story of how Lúthien follows Beren on his quest, and how their quest ends in both triumph and tragedy. What this poem does not fully reveal, what Tolkien keeps for those who seek out the Silmarillion, is that this is one of the greatest love stories in Middle-earth's history, one that Tolkien even found personal connection to himself. For new readers, one of the most surprising elements of this story is Lúthien herself. Given the fairy tale setup, an elven maiden, a noble but doomed mortal, you might expect a standard damsel in distress story, but Tolkien turns that expectation on its head. Lúthien is not just Beren's love, she is his savior. She defies her father and escapes imprisonment to follow Beren. She confronts Sauron himself and defeats him single-handedly, rescuing Beren from captivity. She stands before Morgoth, the Dark Lord, and brings him to his knees with her song. This is not the story of a man rescuing a princess. This is the story of a woman with the power to challenge the very forces of darkness. In some ways, Lúthien is the first great hero of Tolkien's legendarium. Long before Eowyn slays the Witch King, long before Arwen makes her fateful choice, Lúthien proves that courage is not the domain of male warriors alone. Beren, too, is a fascinating figure. He is not a bloodthirsty warrior, not a mighty king. He is simply a man in love. But his love drives him to attempt the impossible. The Lay of Lúthien is not just an old legend. It has direct ties to the characters we know. If you would like to wander farther and explore the story of Lúthien and Beren and its implications for Middle-earth, you can find past episodes of Lore of the Rings, all of which are linked on the free chapter guide for this chapter, which you can download at ringspodcast.com/attack. And so we return to Weathertop. The fire flickers, the night grows colder, the Black Riders are near. But for a moment, the hobbits are somewhere else. They are in a world of song and sorrow, of love and loss, of courage and sacrifice. They are connected to something ancient, something enduring. Strider does not promise them safety. He does not promise that all will end well. But he does offer them a story. And in Middle-earth, let's hope that that is enough, because the agents of darkness are closing in.
This weekend only at Macy's, it's our lowest prices of spring. How low? Diamond rings, pendants, and earrings, only $399, originally $1,500. Ninja blenders, now $89.99. And $395 men's designer suits, only $99.99. So if you're wondering why you should shop Macy's lowest prices sale, well, the name pretty much says it all. It's our lowest prices for one weekend only. Starts tomorrow at Macy's. Savings off already reduced prices. Exclusions apply.
Lord Vader, Operation Andor is underway.
Excellent. If we release 3 episodes per week, the Lorehounds will never be able to cover every episode. The Imperial forces will crush the rebellion before it begins.
Stand by. We're picking up something on our scanners.
Echo Squadron, reporting in.
Delta Squadron, on your left.
Django Squadron, on your 6.
With Imperial forces coming in fast, we're calling all Rebels to join the fight this season. Starting after the April 22nd premiere, you'll hear 3 full breakdowns for each week's episodes of Andor Season 2. Each podcast will be led by one of our squadron leaders, Alicia, David, and John. We'll be bringing in new and familiar voices to fill out the roster. Search for the Lorehounds on any podcast platform to join us in a galaxy far, far away. And don't forget to check out our season pass for even more content like our Holocron bonus pods. It's good news for anyone, except Darth Vader.
The fear begins long before the Black Riders appear. There is something about the night itself, a sense of dread creeping in at the edges. Cold presses in, but this is not the ordinary chill of an autumn evening. This cold feels unnatural, seeping into bones and hearts alike. It is the cold of something wrong, something that does not belong in the living world. And then, the fear takes shape. Merry is the first to notice. This is not the first time he has been the first to sense the enemy. He was also the first to spot a Black Rider on Weathertop. Perhaps it is because he is more observant, or perhaps it is simply unluck, but once again, Merry is the one to glimpse the approaching shapes. But they are not fully seen. Tolkien does not describe them as simply walking into the firelight, fully visible. Instead, we read the hobbits, quote, felt, rather than saw, the shadow rise. The presence of the Nazgul is not just physical, it is psychological. They radiate fear, their presence pressing in even before their dark forms take shape. And then they do appear. At first there are only two or three, then four, then five. There is something unsettling about the way they seem to grow in number, slipping in and out of the shadows. The descriptions are eerie. They are like, quote, black holes in the darkness itself, as though even the night bends around them. The terror that the hobbits feel is deep, almost supernatural, and accompanying it is a bitter cold, one that is mentioned more than once. The breath of the Nazgul is described as venomous, their presence bringing a, quote, thin, piercing chill. This is another way Tolkien makes the reader feel the horror of these creatures. It is not just about seeing something frightening. It is about the creeping sensation of dread, the way it infects the very air around them. For the first time since leaving Bree, Frodo feels the overwhelming urge to put on the ring. This is not just a random impulse. The Nazgul have a power over the ring. They are bound to it, enslaved by it, and in their presence, its pull is stronger than ever. Frodo cannot resist. He slips the ring onto his left forefinger, and suddenly, the world changes. The moment the ring is on, quote, dim, dark shapes became terribly clear. This is a striking reversal. Before, the Nazgul were formless shadows, blackness upon blackness. Now Frodo sees them in full detail. Five figures, with white faces, gray robes, long steel swords, and, quote, merciless eyes. There is something horrifying about this shift. We have spent the entire book knowing the Nazgul as wraiths, faceless, unseen terrors. And now, for the first time, we see what they truly look like. Frodo is no longer in the same world as his companions. He has stepped into the realm of the unseen. The chief of the Nazgul stands before him. His helm bears a crown. This is not his first battle at Weathertop. Long ago, the Witch King fought here during the Wars of Arnor, when he led the forces of Angmar against the kingdom of the Dunedain. Now he returns to the ruins of his old conquests, and he strikes. Frodo, in a final act of effectively involuntary defiance, calls out, quote, O Elbereth Gilthoniel. These words are one of the most mysterious and powerful moments in this scene. What do they mean? Elbereth is another name for Varda, one of the greatest of the Valar, the divine beings who shaped the world. She is the queen of the stars, the one most beloved by the elves. Her name is invoked as a cry of hope, a plea for divine aid. And yet the Witch King strikes. A cold dart of steel, a, quote, dart of poisoned ice, pierces Frodo's left shoulder. The cold now seeps into him directly. If not for Strider, this would be the end. Strider leaps forward, wielding fire. And suddenly, the Nazgul retreat. This is another detail that first-time readers might not fully appreciate. The Nazgul, who are bound to the realm of shadow, fear fire. It is one of the few things that can harm them. Strider does not strike them down, he does not destroy them, but he does enough to drive them back. And as the firelight flickers, Frodo pulls the ring from his finger. He returns to the world of the scene, but the wound remains, and the darkness has already begun to take hold. In Peter Jackson's adaptation, this scene is visually dramatic and captures the visual inversion perfectly, turning ragged figures dressed in black robes to tall white kingly figures. But this adaptation differs in a few key ways. One of the biggest omissions is Frodo's invocation of Elbereth. In the film, he simply falls to the ground, overwhelmed. This removes an important aspect of Tolkien's world, the idea that divine forces, even distant ones, can still have power. The film leans heavily into the idea that the Nazgul are skeletal ghosts when seen through the ring. This is a creative choice, but Tolkien's description suggests something more like faded kings, pale, almost spectral, but not just decayed corpses. In the film, Strider fights the Nazgul directly with a torch and sword, swinging his arms to set the Nazgul on fire. In the book, his use of fire is more of a defensive act, driving them away rather than actively striking them down. Despite these changes, the film captures the most essential element, the terror. The scene is one of growing dread, culminating in a moment that changes Frodo forever. This scene on Weathertop marks a turning point in Frodo's journey. Up until now, Frodo has been pursued by the Black Riders, but they have remained mostly in the shadows, lurking dangerously on the edges of the story. Now they fully emerge, and Frodo is forced into direct confrontation with them. Before this point, the closest he came to actively engaging with the Ring's power was at Tom Bombadil's house, when he put it on to test whether Tom could still see him. But that was in a place of safety, a moment of curiosity. Here, on Weathertop, his choice to put on the ring is driven by something much deeper. Fear, compulsion, and perhaps, in some small way, the first signs of Frodo's breaking under the ring's influence. When he slips it onto his finger, the world changes. Everything that was once unseen, the true forms of the Nazgul, becomes terribly clear. This is a moment of revelation for Frodo, a sign that the ring does not just make him invisible, it shifts him into another reality, one where the wraiths exist in their full power. In a way, it is a preview of what the ring wants to do to him, pull him further into its realm, separate him from the physical world, and bring him closer to the same fate as the Nazgul themselves. And yet, Frodo also shows an amazing resilience. Despite being overwhelmed by terror, Frodo does something remarkable. He fights back. He does not simply cower or surrender to the power of the ring. Instead, he attempts to strike with his sword and calls upon Elbereth, invoking a power beyond himself. This defiance is crucial because it shows that even in the face of overwhelming darkness, Frodo still has a strength within him. A strength that comes not from physical might, but from courage, faith, and the unseen forces of good in Middle-earth. The Witch King's blade is not just steel, it is an instrument of corruption. And while the full effects of the wound are yet to unfold, the mere fact that Frodo is struck is significant. He has been marked by the enemy. This scene is pivotal because it deepens Frodo's connection to the ring and foreshadows what is to come. He has now felt the direct presence of Sauron's servants. He has succumbed to the temptation of the ring's power, and he has suffered a wound that will never fully heal. From this moment forward, Frodo is not just carrying the ring is beginning to claim him. Thank you to this episode's executive producer, The Old One. If you would like to support the Lore of the Rings podcast, visit ringspodcast.com/member. If you found today's Wandering of Middle-earth to be inspiring, please share this episode with a friend. Lastly, if you would like to connect with me, I am most active on Threads. Find a link to my profile at ringspodcast.com and tap the at symbol near the top. And thank you for wandering Middle-earth with me today.
This weekend only at Macy's, it's our lowest prices of spring. How low? Diamond rings, pendants, and earrings, only $399, originally $1,500. Ninja blenders, now $89.99. And $395 men's designer suits, only $99.99. So if you're wondering why you should shop Macy's lowest prices sale, well, the name pretty much says it all. It's our lowest prices for one weekend only. Starts tomorrow at Macy's. Savings off already reduced prices. Exclusions apply.